This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Senlin Ascends, The Books of Babel, Book 1. Written by Josiah Bancroft. Read by John Banks.
The Tower of Babel is sometimes called the sink of humanity. Its immensity, the variety of its ringdoms, its mysterious and luxurious heights are irresistible to all comers. We are drawn to it like water to a drain. Introduction to Everyman's Guide to the Tower of Babel, 14th edition. Part 1. The Basement and the Parlor. Chapter 1. The Tower of Babel is most famous for the silk fineries and marvellous airships it produces, but visitors will discover other intangible exports. Whimsy, adventure, and romance are the tower's real trade. Everyman's Guide to the Tower of Babel. It was a 4-day journey by train from the coast to the desert, where the Tower of Babel rose like a tusk from the jaw of the earth. First, they had crossed pastureland, spotted with fattening cattle and charmless hamlets, and then their train had climbed through a range of snow-veined mountains where condors roosted in nests large as haystacks. Already, they were farther from home than they had ever been. They descended through shale foothills, which he said reminded him of a field of shattered blackboards, through cypress trees, which he said looked like open parasols, and finally they came upon the arid basin. The ground was the colour of rusted chains, and the dust of it clung to everything. The desert was far from deserted. Their train shared a direction with a host of caravans, each a slithering line of wheels, hooves, and feet. Over the course of the morning, the bands of traffic thickened until they converged into a great mass so dense that their train was forced to slow to a crawl. Their cabin seemed to wade through the boisterous tide of stagecoaches and ox-drawn wagons, through the tourists, pilgrims, migrants, and merchants from every state in the vast nation of Ur. Thomas Senlin and Maria, his new bride, peered at the human menagerie through the open window of their sunny sleeper car. Her china-white hand lay weightlessly atop his long fingers. A little troop of red-breasted soldiers slouched by on palominos, parting a family in checkered headscarves on camelback. The trumpet of elephants sounded over the clack of the train, and here and there, in the hot winds high above them, airships lazed, drifting inexorably toward the Tower of Babel. The balloons that held the ships aloft were as colourful as maypoles. Since turning toward the tower, they had been unable to see the grand spire from their cabin window. But this did not discourage Senlin's description of it.
"There is a lot of debate over how many levels there are. Some scholars say there are 52, others say as many as 60. It's impossible to judge from the ground," Senlin said, continuing the litany of facts he'd brought to his young wife's attention over the course of their journey. "A number of men, mostly aeronauts and mystics, say that they have seen the top of it. Of course, none of them have any evidence to back up their boasts. Some of those explorers even claim that the tower is still being raised, if you can believe that."
These trivial facts comforted him, as all facts did. Thomas Senlin was a reserved and naturally timid man who took confidence in schedules and regimens and written accounts. Maria nodded dutifully, but was obviously distracted by the parade of humanity outside. Her wide green eyes darted excitedly from one exotic diversion to the next. What Senlin merely observed, she absorbed. Senlin knew that, unlike him, Maria found spectacles and crowds exhilarating, though she saw little of either back home. The pageant outside her window was nothing like Esau, a salt-scoured fishing village, how many hundreds of miles behind them. Esau was the only real home she'd known, apart from the young women's musical conservatory she'd attended for 4 years. Esau had two pubs, a whist club, and a city hall that doubled as a ballroom when occasion called for it.
but it was hardly a metropolis.
Maria jumped in her seat when a camel's head swung unexpectedly near. Senlin tried to calm her by example, but couldn't stop himself from yelping when the camel snorted, spraying them with warm spit. Frustrated by this lapse in decorum, Senlin cleared his throat and shooed the camel out with his handkerchief. The tea set that had come with their breakfast rattled now, spoons shivering in their empty cups, as the engineer applied the brakes and the train all but stopped. Thomas Senlin had saved and planned for this journey his entire career. He wanted to see the wonders he'd read so much about, and, though it would be a trial for his nerves, he hoped his poise and intellect would carry the day. Climbing the Tower of Babel, even if only a little way, was his greatest ambition, and he was quite excited. Not that anyone would know it to look at him. He affected a cool detachment, as a rule, concealing the inner flights of his emotions. It was how he conducted himself in the classroom. He didn't know how else to behave any more. Outside, an airship passed low enough to the ground that its tethering lines began to snap against heads in the crowd. Senlin wondered why it had dropped so low, or if it had only recently launched. Maria let out a laughing cry and covered her mouth with her hand. He gaped as the ship's captain gestured wildly at the crew to fire the furnace and pull in the tethers, which was quickly done amid a general panic, but not before a young man from the crowd had caught hold of one of the loose cords. The adventuresome lad was quickly lifted above the throng, his feet just clearing the box of a carriage before he was swung up and out of view. The scene seemed almost comical from the ground, but Senlin's stomach churned when he thought of how the youth must feel, flying on the strength of his grip high over the sprawling mob. Indeed, the entire brief scene had been so bizarre that he decided to simply put it out of his mind. The guide had called the market a raucous place. It seemed, perhaps, an understatement. He'd never expected to make the journey as a honeymooner. More to the point, he never imagined he'd find a woman who'd have him. Maria was his junior by a dozen years, but being in his mid-30s himself, Senlin did not think their recent marriage very remarkable. It had raised a few eyebrows in Esau, though. Perched on rock bluffs by the Nero Ocean, the townsfolk of Esau were suspicious of anything that fell outside the regular rhythms of tides and fishing seasons. But as the headmaster and the only teacher of Esau's school, Senlin was generally indifferent to gossip. He'd certainly heard enough of it. To his thinking, gossip was the theatre of the uneducated, and he hadn't gotten married to enliven anyone's breakfast table conversation. He'd married for entirely practical reasons. Maria was a good match. She was good-tempered and well-read, thoughtful, though not brooding, and mannered without being aloof. She tolerated his long hours of study and his general quiet, which others often mistook for stoicism. He imagined she had married him because he was kind, even-tempered and securely employed. He made 15 shekels a week for an annual salary of 13 minas. It wasn't a fortune by any means, but it was sufficient for a comfortable life. She certainly hadn't married him for his looks. While his features were separately handsome enough, taken all together, they seemed a little stretched and misplaced. His nickname among his pupils was the Sturgeon, because he was thin and long and bony. Of course, Maria had a few unusual habits of her own. She read books while she walked to town, and had many torn skirts and skinned knees to show for it. She was fearless of heights and would sometimes get on the roof just to watch the sails of inbound ships rise over the horizon. She played the piano beautifully, but also brutally. She'd sing like a mad mermaid while banging out ballads and reels, leaving detuned pianos in her wake. And even still, her oddness inspired admiration in most. The townsfolk thought she was charming, and her playing was often requested at the local public houses. Not even the bitter grey of Esau's winters could temper her vivacity. Everyone was a little baffled by her marriage to the Sturgeon. Today, Maria wore her travelling clothes, a knee-length khaki skirt and plain white blouse, with a somewhat eccentric pith helmet covering her rolling auburn hair. She had dyed the helmet red, which Senlin didn't particularly like, but she'd sold him on the fashion by saying it would make her easier to spot in a crowd. Senlin wore a grey suit of thin corduroy, which he felt was too casual, even for travelling, but which he had said was fashionable and a little frolicsome, and wasn't that the whole point of a honeymoon, after all? A dexterous child in a rough goatskin vest climbed along the side of the train, with rings of bread hooped on one arm. Senlin bought a ring from the boy, and he and Maria sat sharing the warm, yeasty crust as the train crept toward Babel Central Station, where so many tracks ended. Their honeymoon had been delayed by the natural course of the school year. He could have opted for a more convenient and frugal destination, a seaside hotel or country cottage, in which they might have secluded themselves for a weekend. But the Tower of Babel was so much more than a vacation spot. A whole world stood balanced on a bedrock foundation. As a young man, he'd read about the tower's cultural contributions to theatre and art, its advances in the sciences, and its profound technologies. Even electricity, still an unheard-of commodity in all but the largest cities of Ur, was rumoured to flow freely in the tower's higher levels. It was the lighthouse of civilization. The old saying went, "The earth doesn't shake the tower, the tower shakes the earth." The train came to a final stop, though they saw no station outside their window. The conductor came by and told them that they'd have to disembark. The tracks were too clogged for the train to continue. No one seemed to think it unusual. After days of sitting and swaying on the rails, the prospect of a walk appealed to them both. Senlin gathered their two pieces of luggage, a stitched leather satchel for his effect, and for hers, a modest steamer trunk with large casters on one end and a push handle on the other. He insisted on managing them both. Before they left their car, and while she tugged at the tops of her brown leather boots and smoothed her skirt, Senlin recited the three vital pieces of advice he'd gleaned from his copy of Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. Firstly, keep your money close. Before they'd departed, he'd had their local tailor sew secret pockets inside the waists of his pants and the hem of her skirt. Secondly, don't give in to beggars. It only emboldens them. And finally, keep your companions always in view. Senlin asked Maria to recite these points as they bustled down the gold-carpeted hall connecting train cars. She obliged, though with some humour.
Rule 4. Don't kiss the camels.
That is not Rule 4.
Tell that to the camels,
she said, her gait bouncing. And still, neither of them was prepared for the scene that met them as they descended the train steps. The crowd was like a jelly that congealed all around them. At first, they could hardly move. A bald man, with an enormous hemp sack humped on his shoulder and an iron collar about his neck, knocked Senlin into a red-eyed woman. She repulsed him with an alcoholic laugh, and then shrank back into the swamp of bodies. A cage of agitated canaries was passed over their heads, shedding foul-smelling feathers on their shoulders. The hips of a dozen black-robed women, pilgrims of some esoteric faith, rolled against them like enormous ball bearings. Unwashed children, loaded with trays of scented tissue flowers, toy pinwheels, and candied fruit, wriggled about them, each child leashed to another by a length of rope. Other than the path at the train tracks, there were no clear roads, no cobblestones, no curbs, only the rust-red hardpan of the earth beneath them. It was all so overwhelming, and for a moment Senlin stiffened like a corpse. The bark of vendors, the snap of tarps, the jangle of harnesses, and the dither of 10,000 alien voices set a baseline of noise that could only be yelled over. Maria took hold of her husband's belt, just at his spine, startling him from his daze and goading him onward. He knew they couldn't very well just stand there. He gathered a breath and took the first step. They were drawn into a labyrinth of merchant tents, vendor carts, and rickety tables. The alleys between stands were as tangled as a child's scribble. Temporary bamboo rafters protruded everywhere over them, bowing under jute rugs, strings of onions, punched tin lanterns, and braided leather belts. Brightly striped shade sails blotted out much of the sky, though even in the shade, the sun's presence was never in doubt. The dry air was as hot as fresh ashes. Senlin plodded on, hoping to find a road or signpost. Neither appeared. He allowed the throng to offer a path rather than forge one himself. When a gap opened, he leapt into it. After progressing perhaps 100 paces in this manner, he had no idea which direction the tracks lay. He regretted wandering away from the tracks. They could have followed them to the Babel Central Station. It was unsettling how quickly he'd become disoriented. Still, he was careful to occasionally turn and construct a smile for Maria. The beam of her smile never wavered. There was no reason to worry her with the minor setback. Ahead, a bare-chested boy fanned the hanging carcasses of lambs and rabbits to keep a cloud of flies from settling. The flies and sweet stench wafting from the butcher's stall drove the crowd back, creating a little space for them to pause a moment, though the stench was nauseating. Placing Maria's trunk between them, Senlin dried his neck with his handkerchief.
"It certainly is busy," Senlin said, trying not to seem as flustered as he felt, though Maria hardly noticed.
She was staring over his head, a bemused expression lighting her pretty face.
"It's wonderful," she said.
A gap in the awnings above them exposed the sky, and there, like a pillar holding up the heavens, stood the Tower of Babel. The face of the tower was patched with white, grey, rust, tan and black, betraying the many types of stone and brick used in its construction. The irregular coloration reminded Senlin of a calico cat. The tower's silhouette was architecturally bland, evoking a dented and ribbed cannon barrel, but it was ornamented with grand friezes, each band taller than a house. A dense cloud bank obscured the tower's pinnacle. The Everyman's Guide noted that the upper echelons were permanently befogged, though whether the ancient structure produced the clouds or attracted them remained a popular point of speculation. However it was, the peak was never visible from the ground. The Everyman's description of the Tower of Babel hadn't really prepared Senlin for the enormity of the structure. It made the ziggurats of South Ur and the citadels of the Western Plains seem like models, the sort of thing children built out of sugar cubes. The tower had taken 1,000 years to erect, more, according to some historians. Overwhelmed with wonder and the intense teeming of the market, Senlin shivered. Maria squeezed his hand reassuringly, and his back straightened. He was a headmaster, after all, a leader of a modest community. Yes, there was a crowd to push through, but once they reached the tower, the throng would thin. They would be able to stretch a little and would almost certainly find themselves among more pleasant company. In a few hours, they would be drinking a glass of port in a reasonable but hospitable lodging on the third level of the tower, the baths, locals called it, just as they had planned. They would calmly survey this same human swarm, but from a more comfortable distance. Now, at least, they had a bearing, a direction to push toward. Senlin was also discovering a more efficient means of advancing through the crowds. If he stopped, he found, it was difficult to start again, but progress could be made if one was a little more firm and determined. After a few minutes of following, Maria felt comfortable enough to release his belt, which made walking much easier for them both. Soon they found themselves in one of the many clothing bazaars within the market. Laced dresses, embroidered pinafores and cuffed shirts hung on a forest of hooks and lines. A suit could be had in any colour, from peacock blue to jonquil yellow. Women's intimate apparel dangled from bamboo ladders like the skins of exotic snakes. Square-folded handkerchiefs covered the nearest table in a heap like a snowdrift.
"Let me buy you a dress. The evenings here are warmer than we're used to."
He had to speak close to her ear.
"I'd like a little frock," she said,
removing her pith helmet and revealing her somewhat deflated bronzy hair.
"Something scandalous."
He gave her a thoughtful frown to disguise his own surprise. He knew that this was the kind of flirtation that even decent couples probably indulged in on their honeymoon. Still, he was unprepared and couldn't reflect her playful tone.
"Scandalous?" Nothing your pupils will need to know about. Just a little something to disgrace our clothesline back home, she said, running her finger down his arm, as if she were striking a match.
He felt uneasy. Ahead of them, acres of stores cascaded with women's undergarments. There wasn't a man in sight. 15 years spent living as a bachelor hadn't prepared him for the addition of Maria's undergarments to the landscape of his bedroom. Finding her delicates draped on the bedposts and doorknobs of his old sanctuary had come as something of a shock. But this mass of nightgowns, camisoles, corsets, stockings and brassieres being combed through by thousands of unfamiliar women seemed exponentially more humiliating.
"I think I'll stay by the luggage."
"What about your rules?"
"Well, if you'll keep that red bowl on your head, I'll be able to spot you just fine from here."
"If you wander off, we'll meet again at the top of the tower," she said, with exaggerated dramatic emphasis.
"We will not. I'll meet you right here, beside this cart of socks."
"Such a romantic," she said,
passing around two heavy-set women who wore the blue and white apron dresses popular many years earlier. Senlin noticed, with amusement, that they were connected at the waist by a thick jute rope. He asked them if they were from the east, and they responded with the name of a fishing village that was not far from Esau. They exchanged the usual nostalgia common to coastal folk, sunrises, starfish, and the pleasant muttering of the surf at night. And then he asked,
"You've come on holiday?"
They responded with slight maternal smiles that made him feel belittled.
"We're far past our holidays,"
one said.
"Do you go everywhere, lashed together?"
A note of mockery crept into his voice now.
"Yes, of course," replied the older of the two. "Ever since we lost our little sister."
"I'm sorry. Did she pass away recently?" Senlin asked, recovering his sincere tone.
"I certainly hope not, but it has been 3 years. Maybe she has." "Or maybe she found some way to get back home," the younger sister said. "She wouldn't abandon us," the older replied, in a tone that suggested this was a well-tread argument between them. "It is intrepid of you to come alone," the younger spinster said to him.
"Oh, thank you, but I'm not alone."
Tiring of the conversation, Senlin moved to grip the handle of the trunk, only to find it had moved. Confused, he turned in circles, searching first the ground and then the crowd of blank, unperturbed faces snaking about him. Maria's trunk was gone.
"I've lost my luggage," he said.
"Get yourself a good rope,"
the eldest said, and reached up to pat his pale cheek. Chapter 2 Savvy shoppers will revel in the market that coils about the foot of the tower. Don't be afraid to walk away while haggling. A little retreat may win a great bargain. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. Senlin sat atop a sandstone boulder near the foot of the tower, eating the pistachios he'd bought for breakfast. His chapped lips stung. Small brown birds scavenged through the shells he dropped, picking at the flakes of germ. He didn't recognize the species. A few hours earlier, he'd bought a drink, a single ladle of water that cost as much as a dram of good brandy back in Esau. Already, he was thirsty again. He'd brought a little notebook to record his impressions, as any amateur anthropologist might, but he hadn't cracked it since disembarking from the train. He didn't wish to record any of this. His copy of the Everyman's Guide dangled open in his hand. An untidy bundle of women's undergarments sat at his side. He felt dizzy with exhaustion. His fingers quaked from it. If he laid back on the sun-warmed rock and closed his eyes, he would fall asleep in an instant. He was afraid of doing just that. It was now 2 days since they'd climbed down from the train, 2 days since he'd first glimpsed the tower through the tattered awning, 2 days since she'd turned away and gone laughing in search of a frock, something scandalous. The Tower of Babel swelled before him like the step of a great plateau, a rock face that surged without apparent end.
except for the arched entrance that yawned about a deeply shaded tunnel 100 yards away. The lower span of the tower was unbroken by windows or ledges. Higher up, Senlin could discern a few structures jutting from the tower like thorns from the trunk of an old rosebush. Airships clung to these thorns, their gondolas made as small as aphids by the distance. Skyports, Senlin supposed. He'd read that most levels of the tower, or ringdoms, had several such ports. If only he had come with Maria by airship. But travelling by air was prohibitively expensive. 2 tickets would cost nearly a year's salary. Worse yet, he was prone to seasickness. The locals of Esau often teased him for it. The headmaster of Fishtown can ring his bell, but he can't ride a swell. He hadn't wanted to spend their honeymoon voyage dangling over the rail of an airship, seeding the landscape with the contents of his stomach. Besides, the walk up to their eventual destination, the baths, had been part of the adventure, and Maria had looked forward to it. A sudden realization made him jump and nearly tumble from the rock he sat perched on. The paper sack of pistachios slid from his hand and bounced down the boulder to the ground, the pale shells skittering every which way across the red hardpan. He knew it would be there before he looked, and yet he tore into his satchel, rummaging through the side pocket, past spare pens, his coat brush, and blank postcards, until, at last, his hand closed around the cause of his alarm. He pulled free the pair of train tickets. He had her ticket home. He had been only momentarily distracted by the loss of her luggage, and had gone charging off through the press of hagglers and tourists, without any sense of which direction the thieves had gone. It wasn't long before he conceded that the luggage was lost. He returned to the stall, nearly certain it was the same display of socks they'd stood by just minutes before, and there he spent the first afternoon, and then the first night of their honeymoon in Babel, rocking on his heels all alone. He was certain she would find her way back. He focused himself on being level and rational, and even occasionally optimistic. This wasn't a very great inconvenience. Perhaps it was an adventure, the kind that made vacation stories enjoyable to recount. She would return. But over the course of that night, he'd watched as first one stall and then another was packed up, their stock dragged away by camel and mule, on sleds and in wagons. New merchants arrived. New awnings and tables were raised, changing the topography of the alleys between vendors, changing even the cut-out shape of the sky above him. Now it made sense why the Everyman's Guide didn't include any maps of the market. One might as well try to draw a diagram of tomorrow's sunset. The market's evolution never ceased. When the sock stall where he'd promised to wait was transformed into a vendor of oil lamps, he realized that she would never find her way back to him. He couldn't stand idle any longer. The next day, he undertook a systematic search, beginning with what remained of the silk district of the market where she had disappeared. He searched in an expanding spiral as best he could manage, buying from every few merchants a silk slip or a pair of stockings, some trifle sufficient to get their attention long enough for him to ask if they'd seen a woman in a red helmet in the past day. He was glad, at least, to have an easy way to describe her. A woman in a red helmet. She'd been more clever and prudent than he'd given her credit for. After a day of this, he had accrued an embarrassing bindle of women's clothes. But there was no news of Maria. The clothiers began to turn into potters, and the tables of silks were replaced with galleries of crockery and stoneware. Where the awnings and tents were sparsest, he clambered up on kegs and crates to scan the crowd for her, certain she would stand out, vivid as a cardinal in a tree. But it was impossible to really see anyone distinctly amid the throng. Almost unconsciously, his search began to take him closer to the tower, which turned out to be farther away than it had first seemed. Or perhaps he had only wandered farther from it. He couldn't be sure. As the hours of the second night swam by, he became less organized, less restrained. He wandered about, heedlessly, calling her name. When he saw even a glimpse of red, he'd crash over stalls and vendors, shove aside milling shoppers, shouting breathlessly, "Maria!
Maria!
Only to find a man in a red fez, or a boy carrying a red paper lantern on a pole, or a red blanket peeking from under a horse's saddle. He wasn't accustomed to feeling panic, nor did he know how to console himself when despair descended upon him. Their honeymoon was ruined, that much seemed certain. They would have to fabricate some fable of luxury to tell their friends, and he would, of course, make it all up to her with a quiet weekend in a pastoral cottage. But for the rest of their marriage, she would remember what a terrible trial their honeymoon had been. It was an inauspicious start. Everywhere he looked now, he saw groups of people roped together. Any movement through the crowd was made more difficult by the web of leashes. Why had the guide neglected to mention that little nugget of wisdom? Bring a good rope. Senlin tucked the train tickets into the pages of his everyman's guide, cursing himself for having been so short-sighted as to carry both of their fares. He wondered if she had enough to buy a new ticket, and did the quick sum in his head. He had 7 minas, 16 shekels, and 11 pence to his name, and unless she had been robbed, she would have about the same. A ticket to Esau, even third class, would cost 10 minas at least. No, she hadn't nearly enough. Maria was stranded here. A wishbone of an old man, bald and naked to the waist, staggered past Senlin's boulder lookout, bent double under a sack. Blackened rivers ran down his back from where sweat mingled with the coal he carried. The old slave, goose-necked and tottering, watched only the boot-heels of the well-dressed tourist ahead of him. Both were part of a column of travellers streaming toward the entrance at the tower's base. Otherwise, the ground that collared the tower was noticeably empty. This no-man's land extended 100 paces out from the foot of the tower. Senlin couldn't imagine why this space should be left empty while the market behind him was choked with people.
"Are you lost?"
asked a young man, standing near his feet at the base of the boulder.
"Why do you ask?"
Senlin said. The youth winked in the sunlight, his thick, dark hair glowing with the lustre of oil. He had the broad shoulders, short stature, and narrow waist of an acrobat, and his complexion was a rich olive colour that drew out the gold flecks in his eyes.
"Most people don't lounge about in the skirts. That stone you're sitting on, is it sacred?" "No more than a headstone. It fell a few days ago and landed on a tourist."
"Fell from where?" Senlin asked, appalled. The youth only pointed up in reply. Feeling conspicuous now, Senlin clambered down the smooth face of the boulder.
"I don't understand," Senlin said, dusting his hunkers and straightening his jacket. "The Tower of Babel is the surest construction in the world. It's built on deep bedrock. It doesn't shed boulders like an oak drops acorns. It's a miracle of engineering."
Senlin wagged his everyman's guide at the youth, as if the book proved his point.
"Oh, it's a miracle for sure, but sometimes it dumps a little miracle on us," the youth said. "It doesn't matter if something falls from the second or the 22nd ring. It all crashes on the same ground, the skirts. I wouldn't pitch my tent here if I were you."
This discovery did not jibe at all with Senlin's studies, nor with what he had taught his students about the tower, which were always his favourite lectures. He'd draw schematics of the tower and the network of railroads that radiated out from it. He'd introduce the tower's murky history and the venerable historians who debated its age, original architects, its internal machinations, and its purpose. He even taught them about the baths, famous for its therapeutic spas, where he'd promised to take Maria.
"I've read a dozen accounts of the tower. I've never heard of the skirts. Maybe your books are out of date."
The youth straightened his expression when Senlin didn't return his smile.
"My name is Adamos Boreas. Call me Adam."
Senlin shook the youth's strong hand and introduced himself. The youth's mature tone and self-confidence were a little disarming. Though his beard was still a patchwork of youthful fuzz and tougher bristle, he seemed entirely adult in his address.
"I take it you're in the silk trade?"
Adam nodded at the bindle of women's garments, still sitting atop the morbid boulder. Black silk stockings dangled from the mouth of it.
Gathering up the bundle, Senlin felt momentarily flustered, and his embarrassment was only made worse by the statement, "They're for my wife."
"Where's your wife?"
Adam asked, craning his neck about, searchingly. Senlin's tongue felt as dry and stiff as a leather belt. He thought he might gag if he tried to swallow. He would have given a king's ransom for a drink of anything, and yet worse than his thirst was the confession that stood lodged in his swollen throat. He felt as he had on his first day in front of a class, like a fraud. What sort of husband loses a wife? Tugging the parcel of silks down from the boulder and clamping it under his arm, he squared Adam with a singular, miserable smile and said, "It's odd you should mention my wife. I seem to have lost her."
Chapter 3
The happy traveller will look for the broadest, most beaten path, will look to his fellow traveller for behavioural cues, will be an echo, but will not raise his voice. It is dangerous to blaze a trail when one is already so clearly cut. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. The berth in their sleeper car had hardly been wide enough for the two of them to occupy at once. They had to lie shoulder to shoulder, with the ceiling not an arm's length away. The mountain pines made the moon flicker through their window like a stroboscope, and the car swayed as tenderly as a cradle. Senlin was unprepared for marriage in every way. He possessed neither the imagination nor emotional warmth that intimacy required. So he lay there on his back, like a fish stranded by the tide, a sturgeon gasping out of water. Here was the moon and the rocking crib, and the far-from-prying eyes, and every romantic thing a man could request. And what did he do with it? He was drowning in opportunity. Maria lay propped on her elbow, watching him appear to sleep with his eyes open. She pressed the flat of her finger against his cheek, lifting up a smile, like a fishhook, trying to tease some life from him. She tugged at his earlobe, bit lightly at his shoulder, and blew on his neck. Still he lay, sometimes flinching, but not responding.
"Tell me, Tom, how deep is the well beneath the tower?"
Senlin swallowed, his throat ribbiting like a frog.
6,000 feet, as I recall."
6,000 feet? If the well was wide enough to drop the tower into..."
Senlin interrupted, stuttering.
Impossible. The well would collapse if it..."
Maria pressed on in a voice hardly above a whisper.
"If it were wide enough, would the tower be tall enough to fill the well?"
He considered it.
"It's possible, I suppose. If there are 60 levels at 100 feet apiece, it's possible,"
she said, her mouth near his blushing ear.
Possible, he confirmed.
And the moon flickered through the aspens, and the car soared from side to side, carrying them further from familiar things. The dark-haired youth dipped his head out of respect or abashment at Senlin's obvious straining. The headmaster's neck was stretched so drastically that the ribs of his throat showed.
"If it makes you feel any better, you aren't the first to lose someone."
Senlin took Adam for a local, or perhaps a visitor of such long standing that he'd become an emigre. He knew too much to be a tourist.
"I was hoping she would pass by here. I don't suppose you've seen a woman wearing a red sun helmet?" "That's not much of a description."
This was the first time he'd been encouraged to say more about his lost wife. All his other inquiries had been met with dismissive gestures, a waved hand or a shallow shrug. Though he felt a little uneasy, hope overrode his preference for discretion. He forced himself to describe her more fully.
"She is about your height, slender, with auburn hair, and pale skin. Pretty."
"No luggage?"
Adam asked, and Senlin shook his head.
"About your age?"
Senlin hesitated.
"More youthful."
A small bird with a dark tail swooped between them and began picking, unperturbed by their presence,
at the spilled pistachios.
"That is a blackstart," Senlin said, identifying the bird.
He was relieved to have a momentary distraction.
"They're a determined species, from what I've read. Aren't afraid of much."
As if to test the bird, Adam moved his toe nearer it. The bird hopped pertly on the top of his boot and rebounded into the red sand. Adam snorted his amusement.
"You a bird watcher?"
Senlin shook his head.
"Just an armchair naturalist. I'd never seen one in person before today."
Senlin had the distinct impression that the young man was looking him up and down, measuring him in some way.
"I suppose you've already visited our little lost and found," Adam Boreas said, and taking Senlin's blank expression as answer, offered an explanation. "Where the lost post notes."
Senlin brightened.
"Of course. Surely hundreds of people had wandered away from their companions before. He wasn't the first to lose someone in the market. It made perfect sense that there existed a forum for reuniting people. Would you take me to it?"
"I will," Adam said. "But it won't help."
"Let me be the judge."
"Please," Senlin said, stowing the guidebook in his satchel.
"Lead the way."
Following Boreas toward the base of the mountainous tower, Senlin felt momentarily hopeful. The willingness with which Adam had responded to his direction reminded him of how his commands were received in his classroom. Perhaps he wasn't entirely incapable after all. The skirts were as barren as a salt pan, flat as an iron, and almost as hot. The sun seemed to shine from both the sky and the earth at once. When he'd first spotted the tower through the shaking frame of their cabin window, many miles removed, it had appeared like a dark scratch on the blue lens of the sky. Now it seemed like a sheer corner in the earth, as if the ground and gravity and every natural thing had been folded upward. The market experienced two nights, the natural night of the earth and the strange gloom of the tower's shadow. They were fortunate now to be approaching the tower while it was still sunlit, though the tower's umbra crept nearer like the hand of a monstrous sundial. In a few minutes, the tower's night would fall on them. Boreas led him to one side of the gate, where the flow of traffic naturally thinned. All along the curved length of the tower's base, figures leaned and kneeled against the wall, their faces pressed close. They seemed like pilgrims praying to a shrine. The facade was papered with sheets and scraps of paper, as far up as Senlin's arm could reach. These weathered, discolored tatters were layers deep, wrapping the enormous blocks of granite in a shell of papier-mâché.
"Aren't they afraid of being hit by falling rocks?" Senlin asked, indicating the readers to either side of them.
"Some urges are more immediate than fear," Boreas replied.
It was a moment more before it dawned on Senlin that this endless tatter of paper was the lost and found. He suspected Boreas was watching him for a response, so even as he felt hope leave him, he formed his shoulders and chin into the posture he used for lecturing.
"It only makes sense that there would be so many. I suppose it is like this all the way around."
"I haven't walked it myself, but I imagine so," Adam said.
"Of course. And these people risking death from above are searching for notes from lost loved ones."
Senlin leaned in and read one of the fresher scraps of paper. The fine cursive suggested that the author was well educated. It read, "Robert, I will find my way home. Come after me. Love, Mrs. K. Prophet." This note led him to the next, more crudely drawn and in pencil.
"My dear Lizzie, I wait for you every day at noon at Owl's Gate. I'm under your yellow umbrella. Your loving husband, Abraham Weiss."
The neighbouring note simply read,
"Hulo, I give you up to your new life. Don't look for me. G-Lo."
He read another and another, sliding his nose from one announcement of heartbreak or hope to the next. He felt the beginning of a compulsion growing within him, felt the urge to read just one letter more. The next might be in her handwriting, or the next. But he quickly realized
that he could fritter the rest of his life reading his way around the tower and still never find a note from Maria. One might not even exist, or might have existed, but been buried under another's desperate post. The contents of the notes he'd read brought on a more unsettling revelation. It occurred to him, for the first time, that their parting might be more than an inconvenience. He might never find her. Maria might be lost for good, might perish from exposure or illness or violence. She might be absorbed into another's life, become another man's love, a younger man, a man who wouldn't lose her so quickly.
"Useless," he said.
Assuming that he referred to the overwhelming breadth of the lost and found, Boreas said, "I spent my fair share of hours crossing my eyes at this wall."
"You've lost someone?"
"My sister, Velita."
"How long ago?"
2 years and a month.
"Oh, my word!"
Senlin felt faint. His knees gave without warning, and he dropped into an awkward crouch with his back to the tower.
"What about the local authorities? The magistrates? Who polices the bazaar?"
"There are a few roaming constables. You'll occasionally see a man in a khaki uniform, but half the time they aren't really officials of any kind. They're thugs who stole the uniform, or bought it. Even the real constables can be treacherous. I've known more than a few men who've been beaten and robbed by them."
Adam rubbed his neck, exposing a circular scar on his forearm. The wound was so perfectly round, it could have been drawn with a compass.
"Is the tower entirely ungoverned?"
"It's a little better inside, and even better higher up. There are many ringdoms where one power or another has taken up the law." A woman with bruised, hooded eyes, who had been scrutinizing the wall beside Senlin, now began to read over his head as if he was not there. He had to crawl around her to return to his feet. The woman's blank expression could have been the work of a hypnotist, but what began as pity for her quickly turned to private resolve. He had to shake himself free of the stupor that had claimed him since Maria had vanished. He'd spent the last days running around with an uncharacteristic lack of consideration. He hadn't taken the situation seriously enough at first, and then he'd allowed panic to direct him. If he expected to find Maria, he would have to rely on his reasoning, his ability to observe and analyze. He was not as helpless as this poor wretch, inching her life away, perusing the scroll of the doomed. He had his wits. The courage would come. For now, he had to think. After her initial shock had faded, how would Maria have reacted? Without a ticket to take her home, she would have to navigate the common mire of vendors and thieves on her own. She would naturally seek a safer refuge. She was not without resources. She had some money of her own, secreted in her waistband. Not an extravagant amount, but enough to keep her in room and board for a while. There were no permanent accommodations in the market, and he doubted that she would hire a tent to sleep in. It made sense, then, that she would enter the tower, knowing, of course, that they had intended to lodge on the third level in the baths. They had not settled on a particular hotel, because it was impossible to make reservations from such a distant town as Esau, but she would have no problem securing a room. What had she said just before they parted? "We'll meet again at the top of the tower." Wasn't the baths their pinnacle? Wasn't that the limit of their resources? Adam's promise of improved law and order gave him further confidence in the idea. There was really only one thing to do. Go after his wife, who had gone on ahead.
"Mr. Boreas, you seem familiar with the market. How familiar are you with the ringdoms of the tower?"
"I know the lower four very well."
"That's all I need. Would you be willing to share your experience for a day or two? I would compensate you for your time."
"I could use the work, I must admit."
"Can you begin at once?"
"Give me one moment," Boreas said, and unfolded a brilliantly white piece of stationery. As he tacked it to the wall, Senlin could not help but read the clearly blocked words, which read, "Velita, a rescue is coming. Adam." Boreas caught him looking and responded with an ironic smirk. "A superstitious habit." Senlin tried to keep his smile from seeming condescending, but he couldn't help thinking of it as an indulgence, a compulsion that Boreas had mistaken for hope. Senlin was preparing to make some remarks on the virtues of pragmatism when they were interrupted by a smattering of distant screams. The cries, as if contagious, quickly spread to a chorus. Senlin turned just in time to see the blur of something plunging down, something that was as big as a barn. It crashed against the packed earth with a thunderous boom. Chapter 4 The camaraderie between travellers becomes more palpable the closer one draws to the tower. Do not be surprised if you find yourself swept up in a spontaneous parade. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. The cloud of red dust surged at them so rapidly it was as if they were falling into it. Senlin shielded his face a split second before splinters and pebbles began to pelt him. A piece of shrapnel passed through his splayed fingers and stung his cheek. He clapped his hand over the flash of pain. The debris pinged and ricocheted everywhere, needling his skin and crackling against the tower. A series of hollow woomphs reverberated through the ground, drumming the earth like meteors. When he dared to squint again into the billowing, blotting storm of red grit, he couldn't see any farther than his hand. He watched the blood on his fingers quickly turn to mud. A moment later, the hail changed direction. Instead of coming in sideways, the ejector began to rain dryly on their shoulders and the tops of their heads. Adam, coughing into the crook of his arm, emerged from the dusky haze at Senlin's side, looking unsteady but uninjured. Senlin pulled the lapel of his corduroy jacket over his mouth and nose, and tried to draw a clear breath amid the scattering fog. The initial screams of shock, briefly silenced by the crash, now began to rise again. The tone of the cries had changed. The fear and surprise were gone, replaced by excitement, eagerness, delight. A breeze swept the red cloud away, unveiling the wreckage, hardly a stone's throw distant from them. Much of the wreck was draped and snagged with tattered silk that billowed like cobwebs in the wind. As the air cleared further, he began to make out the tangled limbs of bodies amid the wreckage, a limp hand dangling from a broken wrist, a knee bent unnaturally under a turned foot, a man cracked like a broken book with the back of his head between his heels. The separate woomphs he'd heard had not been falling stars, but tumbling, doomed aeronauts. Senlin loved nothing more in the world than a warm hearth to set his feet upon and a good book to pour his whole mind into. While an evening storm rattled the shutters and a glass of port wine warmed in his hand, Senlin would read into the wee hours of the night. He especially delighted in the old tales, the epics in which heroes set out on some impossible and noble errand, confronting the dangers in their path with fatalistic bravery. Men often died along the way, killed in brutal and unnatural ways. They were gored by war machines, trampled by steeds, and dismembered by their heartless enemies. Their deaths were boastful and lyrical, and always, always more romantic than real. Death was not an end. It was an ellipsis. There was no romance in the scene before him. There were no ellipses here. The bodies lay upon the ground like broken exclamation points. It had been an airship. The enmeshed corpses had been her crew. What or who had brought it down, Senlin couldn't guess, but he knew with absolute certainty that just minutes before it had been a graceful machine, a flight bobbing in the blue sky. Even as this morbid realization dawned on him, the wreck was swamped by market-goers. Corpulent merchants and stiff-legged soldiers scrabbled through the cracked ribs of the hull, turning through the shambles of crates and cargo. Well-dressed men in brushed bowlers and women in holiday bonnets followed near behind, lured into the skirts by the promise of loot. The cries Senlin heard were not of rescue or of mourning, but of laying claim.
"Mine! I saw it first! I had it in my hand before you!"
They scoured the ship's wreckage with the efficiency of crabs cleaning the bones of a beached fish. Some ran off, clutching armfuls of silk, the bottom half of a keg of grain, a coil of rope, an iron cannonball, a bent brass monkey, a pair of cuffed boots. Then men with crowbars came and salvaged planks, rails, hatches, and even one miraculously preserved pane of stained glass. Senlin couldn't look away, though the sight sickened him. He was shocked to see such barbarism at the foot of the Tower of Babel. Such desperation. He wanted to gather all the looters up, sit them in rows, face them forward, and remind them of their servility. Desperate times were never improved by the surrendering of ideals. In a very few minutes, the only thing that remained of the disaster was a crater, a fine confetti of debris, and the nearly stripped bodies of the crew. And then, as if a curtain had been drawn over the whole shameful scene, the shadow of the tower passed over them. The semi-gloom of the tower's nightfall made Senlin shiver. He cleared his throat and turned toward Adam, silhouetted by the rapidly fleeing line of sunlight.
"Who will bury them?" Senlin rubbed tenderly at the dust-clotted gash in his cheek.
"The vultures," Adam said grimly. "We should go. The passage into the basement is a little long."
He loosed his leather belt from his canvas trousers, forming a loop with the buckle on one end. He pulled the loop around his wrist and offered the other end to Senlin. Though a little chagrined, Senlin took the leash.
"Hold to it. The passage gets a little pinched."
He followed after Adamus, like a sleepy dog walker, or conversely, like a sleepy dog. Glancing over his shoulder, he saw the woman with darkly ringed eyes pull a candle stub from her dress pocket. She struck a match, set it to the wick, and continued reading the letters of the lost by the candle's jaundiced light. 3 months earlier, Senlin had stood at the head of his classroom, pinching a diamond of chalk and sketching the last angle in a diagram of the Tower of Babel. A windowless house with large gables, the school sat on blocks at the end of Esau's main avenue. Each spring, the schoolhouse was painted white, as a bribe, and every year the oceanic element slowly undressed it. Senlin loved every knot in every board of that leaky, drafty house. He wore the long black coat and slender black trousers that were his uniform and preference. His voice filled the room to the high, bare rafters. The tufts of a bird's nest showed on the central beam. "At its base, the Tower of Babel's wall is 1/4 mile thick," Senlin said. "Which means the entrances to the tower, if there are 8, must carry visitors through 1/4 mile of solid stone." He turned on his boot heel, squared coattails flaring at his hip, and regarded the 4 rows of ancient cedar desks. His current students were the usual crop, straight-backed, sleepy-eyed boys and girls, ranging in age from 8 to 16. He tapped the chalk diamond to his temple.
"Imagine that! You go home and open the front door to your house, and then have to walk 500 paces before you're even inside the mudroom. That's quite a threshold. And then you'll have only arrived in the first ringdom of the tower."
When they didn't respond with the astonished looks he thought the subject deserved, he called upon the lad in the back row, Colin Weeks, who had gone nearly wall-eyed from daydreaming.
"Mr. Weeks, remind the class what a ringdom is."
Startled out of his reverie, Mr. Weeks lurched forward in his seat, pegging his stomach on the lip of the desk and inducing a little grunt.
"Oof,"
he said. Seats creaked as the heads of other students turned toward him. The barn swallow in the rafters let out a poorly timed warble.
"Miss Stubbs, I trust that you completed the assigned reading. Can you come to Mr. Weeks's assistance?"
Senlin said, turning to a sharp-nosed girl who occupied the front row like the proud figurehead of a ship.
"Yes, headmaster. The levels of the tower are called ringdoms because they are like little round kingdoms," she said, in a piercing but intelligent tone. "They're like the 36 states of Ur, each unique in their way, but instead of being spread out across the map, the ringdoms are stacked up like a birthday cake."
The class tittered at her spontaneous analogy, amused to think of the great Tower of Babel as a layered cake.
"Quite so.
And does the Tower of Babel have a king? Senlin curtly clapped chalk from his palms.
It has many monarchies and democracies and bureaucracies too, she said. It's like a mincemeat pie.